May it please the court. It was an abuse of discretion to find that the state had not entered into an agreement with Robert Richmond in return for his testimony against Mr. Andrus in this case. In Jackson, the Jackson case in 2001, this court condemned the common practice of the prosecutors in this state when they entered into implicit understandings or agreements in exchange for testimony by inmates against defendants. The Jackson case was issued after the facts in this case. The practices that the court condemned were, I suggest, common at the time that the facts occurred in this case. That is...
Well, but there's one significant difference that you're going to have to help us with. In Jackson, this court found that there was an agreement, an implicit understanding. Here, the judge held a hearing and assessed the credibility of at least four different witnesses and said, I find Richmond not to be credible. I find the other witnesses to be credible. And the court made a factual finding that there was no agreement.
Yes.
Now, how do we deal with that on appeal?
That's an abuse of discretion because of what the court didn't consider. The whole genesis of this stemmed from Richmond's letters soon after he testified, complaining about he had a deal, he wasn't getting the benefit of the deal. He sent this to the court, to the prosecutors. And then shortly after those letters issued, he got the deal. And our case was built around those letters. And the lower court didn't address them in any significant way other than mentioning them. He focused on Richmond's testimony 14 years after. And he found him not to be credible based upon his problem and inconsistencies recalling events 14 years ago, which really isn't surprising. The focus should have been in what is in the letters and did the acts that occurred after that, were they consistent with the deal that were suggested in the letters?
Let me stop you for a second here. Your client at trial testified unequivocally that there was no agreement, right?
No, Mr. Richmond, I represent the defendant who didn't testify.
Oh, right, I'm sorry. The witness testified unequivocally that there was no agreement.
Right.
Right, okay. And yet, immediately after, or very shortly after the trial, the witness was busy trying to get the benefit of what he contended was an agreement. So right out of the bat, we've got an inconsistency from out of his own mouth, so to speak, right? So that raises a certain credibility problem, right?
Well, I don't think so because...
Well, wait a second.
Okay, I'm sorry.
You're going to tell me that somebody who's under oath and says, I have no agreement with the state, and then a month later sends a letter saying, I've had an agreement with you guys, why aren't you living up to it? You think that can be reconciled as being honest statements in both cases?
I think it can show his self-interest. He was represented by a counsel who knows the reason that the state doesn't want to have these formal agreements. And it's clear, in the prosecutor in Jackson, as set forth in that opinion, made it clear it would undermine the credibility.
Okay. Right. He was represented by Mr. Gabe, who testified in the proceeding that we now are on appeal. The judge would have to conclude, based on where you seem to be heading, that Mr. Gabe was content with his client testifying falsely that there wasn't an agreement because that would be detrimental to the state's case, notwithstanding the fact there was an agreement. So that would be suborning perjury. And then, in addition, during the hearing that's the subject of this appeal, Mr. Gabe testified falsely under oath that there was no agreement. Isn't that correct?
Yes, Your Honor. In Jackson, the same thing happened, but you found there was, the court found there was a deal. The defense attorney for the, I think his name was Johnson, testified there was no deal. The court looked past the that, what they disregarded what the prosecutor said, what the defense attorney said, and found that there was a deal. That's what the case is in this case. If you look at the facts, Mr. Yabe specifically asked Judge Herlihy to hold up ruling on the Rule 61 until after he testified. There can only be one explanation for that, and that is that based on his testimony, he was going to get a benefit from that.
Let me go at this from a slightly different perspective. His name is Richardson, right?
Richmond.
Richmond, sorry. Mr. Richmond's on the witness stand. He's giving testimony that's harmful to your client.
Yes.
And he gets cross-examined. And he gets asked first, you know, do you have any agreements? No, absolutely not. Nothing at all, nothing at all. Does it really matter that much? Because can't you then go through a cross-examination that says, oh, so you expect us all to believe that you just one day woke up in the morning in your jail cell and decided that, you know, you had some information you wanted to help out the state with because you're such a fine citizen. And, you know, you get what I'm driving at.
Yes.
You know, isn't it transparent that anyone in his circumstances who has come forward to testify is doing it at least in his own belief that it's going to be good for him, even if there is no actual agreement?
I agree with the court. Nobody could think that Mr. Richmond was doing this out of goodness of his heart and wasn't trying to derive a benefit for it. But to the extent that he was concealing that, that's and that deprives the defendant of powerful impeachment material.
But what I'm saying is, don't you show him to be as much of a dishonest witness by having him say, oh, I just did this because I'm such a good citizen?
Well, I mean, you can, but it's not as powerful as showing, hey, I'm getting a deal for this. I mean, there is, you can attack the person's credibility by showing his motives that, you know, he wants something, but he was concealing that, and, you know, there was an understanding here. Now, the state and, you know,
but
there's...
Let me interrupt you just briefly because I want you to focus on the understanding.
Okay.
If we look at this, we have kind of a choice.
Yes.
Of what was really going on. One is that there really was an agreement you get out right away, consistent with these letters he's writing. And the second was there was an expectation on his part,
right,
that was abstract, but it was a legitimate expectation that if he helped the state would help him. And the third is that the only real arrangement was they would make sure he didn't get injured in prison, and they'd put him in some secure area, you know, so he wouldn't be in the general prison population. What does the record support? Was there actually an agreement, or are we talking about number two, which is an expectation, or are we talking about number three? It's undisputed they were going to put him in protective custody, and there was some need to disclose that.
I think the circumstances are of an understanding consistent with the way this happens in reality. It's, you know, wink and a nod is the way it's put in some of the cases. But I think if you look at the hearing on the motion to modify the sentence, the prosecutor states two reasons for this. Number one is for security. They're going for this reduction in the sentence out of security concerns. That's bogus. In Delaware, we don't let people serving sentences for sex crimes out because of security concerns. We transfer them to other states. That's a bogus reason. Ms. Norris testified that they routinely transfer people to different institutions. So then you're left with...
Okay, but before we... just stay with that part of the record. If you look at the transcript in that regard, Mr. Letang said two things in response to what you've just recited. First, interestingly enough, he used the term wink and nod. And he said in all of his years as a prosecutor, he never engaged in winking and nodding. So we come back to my very first question in the argument today, which is the credibility assessment that the judge believed Letang when he said he didn't wink and nod. The second point that's somewhat not related is Letang testified he couldn't get the prison officials to cooperate. And out of frustration, because Richmond had testified, he decided that he would support the application for the early release, but it was only as a result of not being able to get the prison officials to cooperate.
That, Your Honor, that doesn't make any sense, because at the time, from the week before the trial, Richmond was in protective custody, and even after his sentence was modified, he was still in protective custody. He wrote a letter to Judge Herlihy 6 months later, said, I'm still in protective custody.
Mr. Modica, let me try to attack this from a different angle. I think the first statement that you made in your opening presentation was that your client is claiming that it was an abuse of discretion for the trial judge to find that Richmond got nothing in exchange for his plea deal.
Right.
Correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
So the abuse of discretion that you're arguing here relates to a finding of fact.
Yes, Your Honor.
So then the question necessarily becomes, what is it in the record that would compel us to find that the court abused its discretion in finding the facts one way rather than the other? And particularly where there was a live hearing that included testimony and documents. And I gather your essential argument is that the court abused its discretion by giving any credence to the live testimony and should have relied solely upon the letters that Mr. Richmond wrote and taken them at face value. Is that right?
It should have given significance to them.
Well, not just significance,
okay,
but overwhelming significance.
Okay.
Correct? Conclusive significance.
In conjunction with the facts that of the reasons stated for the sentence modification, which are, as I said, number one of them doesn't make any sense, security concern. And then number two, it was, well, he testified well at trial, which is kind of an after fact.
If it weren't for those letters, you would have no case. I mean, at least you would have no position in this proceeding before us, correct?
That's where we first learned that there may have been...
No. Answer my question. Without those letters, your claim of abuse of discretion would not stand. Is that right?
That's part of the abuse of discretion, Your Honor.
It may be part, but there would be no abuse of discretion, would there, if you took those letters out of the equation?
No, there's abuse of discretion by looking at the circumstances of the reasons for the stated.
So we can ignore those letters.
No,
you're saying that the record is sufficient, that even if we ignore the letters, we would still be compelled as a matter of law to find that the court found the facts the wrong way.
No, I'm not saying to ignore the letters. I'm saying that's a really important aspect of the abuse of discretion.
Well, Mr. Modica, you know, you're here to argue, or at least to persuade us, that as a matter of law there was an error of some kind.
Yes.
And whenever we're trying to ask you about what the law is, you start going back to the facts and the evidence. That's a trial court type argument. It's
okay.
Not an appellate argument. So tell us what the rule of law would be if we were to rule the way you're asking us to rule.
Well, that the definition of abuse of discretion is it's got to be the result of a orally deductive process. And what I'm saying is, and I perhaps I'm not appreciating or understanding the question. But the abuse of discretion that I've asserted is that the court did not consider and address those letters, and that the court did not.
Well, the court didn't consider the letters, or the court didn't give exclusive weight to the letters? Because the record, I believe, would show that the court considered all the evidence and weighed it and came out in a way that wasn't to your client's liking.
I don't think he mentioned the letters. He didn't address whether they were believable, their significance in any way. He focused on the testimony of Richmond and found, because of his criminal record, he wasn't credible, and inconsistencies, recalling things 14 years ago, that he wasn't credible.
Well, but if the trial court makes a credibility determination and decides that a certain witness is not credible, why would that witness's writings be any more credible than the witness himself?
Because of the timing of them, Your Honor. It's consistent with what happened. It's consistent with the stated reasons for the sentence modification. Letang said it was because he testified well.
But all of those would be good arguments for why the judge should believe the witness's position on a disputed issue of fact. Fine. So there were some pieces of fact that would favor a finding in your favor. There were other aspects of the evidence that was presented that were definitely in opposition. When there's disputed facts, the trial court makes a decision. How can we say, looking at it on a record, that, oh, well, there wasn't sufficient evidence here for the trial court to have found the way it did?
I acknowledge there was sufficient evidence to support the judge's ruling. He made credibility determinations.
Then why isn't that the end of the analysis?
Because he didn't consider key parts of the record, the letters.
There was evidence sufficient to go either way, correct?
I believe so.
Okay.
Yes.
It's for the court to determine which way to find the fact, and credibility was an essential ingredient.
Yes.
Judge made a credibility determination and came out the way he did. On what principle can we hold that that was an error of law?
It's within the court's discretion to find credibility. I don't want to repeat. I just don't think he considered a part of the record.
You only have about a minute and a half of your reserve time. Do you want to save that?
Yes, please. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Justice Holland, Justice Berger, Justice Jacobs. May it please the court. The trial judge did not abuse his discretion in denying the reserve post-conviction relief Robert Richmond Brady claim in this particular case. The court held a fairly lengthy four-day hearing in 2009. This was a continuation of a claim that had been reserved from the prior post-conviction proceedings for both Mr. Andrus and the co-defendant Jeffrey Fogg because of Richmond's unavailability to testify at the original Rule 61 evidentiary hearing in Newcastle County Superior Court. As the finder of fact at this 2009 hearing, the Superior Court judge correctly concluded that career criminal Robert Richmond was not a credible witness, and that the contrary testimony of the two trial prosecutors and Richmond's own attorney, Mr. Gabay, was more credible in this particular case.
Mr. Williams, let me ask you to focus on what I think may be the legal issue in this case. The trial judge made a factual finding that there was no agreement. So we'll assume that is the state of the record. But you recall at the end of the Superior Court's opinion, there was a discussion of three different cases from other jurisdictions about expectations. And the legal issue that may be implicated in this appeal is whether expectations that don't rise to an agreement need to be disclosed under Brady. And I think what Mr. Monica is arguing is that a fair reading of the record would lead one to conclude somewhere along the line, something was said to the effect, if you help us, maybe we'll be able to help you. No agreement, simply that. And to that extent, it's consistent with Mr. Gabe wanting to put off Richmond's hearing until he was done testifying to see whether he would be helpful. And then, as it turned out, things went pretty well for Mr. Richmond. So my question to you is, should Delaware join the line of cases that say expectations need to be disclosed under Brady, or should we decline to do that? And it's as simple as, you help us and maybe we'll help you. No agreement, but an expectation that if you're helpful, we may be helpful.
Well, I think the better case is the Fifth Circuit 2010 decision that the trial judge cites. It's United States versus Davis. And subjective thoughts of witnesses, if there's no other evidence to support that, that's not sufficient. The reliance that Andrus makes is upon a New York appellate decision from 1973 called People versus Ford. And the trial judge points out that People versus Ford has not been followed by any other court that the judge could find, and that he thought that it was appropriate that there wasn't a need to disclose a witness's subjective expectation of some future leniency, that was just not the best standard. The better standard was as enunciated in United States versus Davis, the Fifth Circuit decision. And I think that's appropriate, because the problem is, who knows what's in some witness's mind? All that we really have in the record is that Mr. Gabe testified, I think at some point, that he thought, well, if Richmond went ahead and revealed this incriminatory information he had derived from Mr. Andrus through their conversations at Gander Hill, that he would get some points for it. At the trial in 1996, Mr. Foley, Andrus's attorney, knew that Robert Richmond had a pending Rule 61 motion. He had filed a pro se motion, and then Mr. Gabe was actually appointed later on to represent him in that proceeding. So that was well known, and that was revealed to the jury. So the jury knew that this individual, while he's sitting there saying that there's no promises under oath, he also has a pending Rule 61 post-conviction relief motion. That was revealed.
I'm just trying to ascertain what your legal point is. Is it that, in essence, the expectation that Justice Holland referred to was disclosed to the defense? And so even if Delaware adopted the line of cases that cited in Mr. Modica's brief, it wouldn't require a reversal?
Well, I think that may very well be. I mean, because Mr. Foley at the Rule 61 renewed hearing that we had, when I pointed out to him that, you know, you had questioned Mr. Richmond back in 1996 about this, so you obviously knew that Mr. Richmond had something pending, and he conceded that, yes, he did.
Well, I mean, if there had to be some Brady-type disclosure, the disclosure, I presume, would be that Mr. Richmond had some expectation that if he testified, you know, truthfully for the state, that the state might do something to help him later on. Assume that was disclosed. Assume it was disclosed.
Okay.
I think I understand you to be saying that in this case it was precisely that subject that Mr. Richman was cross-examined about by defense counsel at the in the 1996 trial.
Yes, he was.
And so whatever benefit would be obtained from this Brady disclosure was, in fact, obtained.
Well, I think that's very true, that, you know, it was within counsel's knowledge that he had a court proceeding pending, a Rule 61 motion pending. And he cross-examined Mr. Richman about that. And this was after Mr. Richman had said that there were no promises. So I think all that was revealed for the jury to weigh Mr. Richman's credibility in deciding whether or not his incriminatory admissions from Andrus were or were not believable here. So I don't think that the defense was certainly put at any disadvantage here. And I do think the better rule is what is announced in Davis, that you simply can't control what's in some witness's subjective mind. I mean, he may have all sorts of unrealistic hopes. And
well, in terms of a policy, wouldn't you agree that the way the Attorney General's office operates is that any time a criminal has information that could be helpful for a significant case like a murder trial, that the Attorney General's office, number one, is very interested in hearing about it, and number two, without making any promises, is certainly going to take that into account with respect to anything else that that particular witness may be facing on his own part? I mean, isn't that kind of the unwritten, unspoken quid pro quo that motivates both sides there?
Well, I think that's probably true. I mean,
what I'm getting at is that if it is something that should be understood and that the prosecutors can testify truthfully that, oh, no, we had no agreement, but still, if the prosecutors ask, you know, weren't you going to see what you could do without any agreement? You know, the answer would be, well, I might, yeah. So if that's the state of affairs, if that's the truth of the way these kinds of discussions go, then shouldn't the jury always hear that, no, there were no understandings, but, yes, the state, as is its standard practice, encouraged this person to come forward and give us this evidence and indicated that, you know, we certainly will take that into consideration with respect to any of his issues. Why shouldn't that kind of be the standard that is disclosed?
Well, I don't know if it's disclosed or just understood or what, but, I mean, I think what happened here is not atypical. There was no agreement with this individual. However, he already had a pending Rule 61. He had an attorney who was advocating on his behalf, and the attorney said that he hoped he would get some points for it down the road, and he did testify, and after that...
But did that come out at the trial, you know, at Andrus' trial? Because as Justice Berger said, if it's one thing to just have a state's witness who's got nothing pending. But if you have a state witness who has charges pending and they're hoping to get points, the legal question is, should the state disclose that it's called a witness with pending charges and that there's no agreement, but that the pending charges aren't going to be disposed of until after the testimony in this trial is complete? You know, it's one thing to just leave it up to the defense to figure that out and cross-examine a person. But the legal question is that something that should be made known by the state, that it's called a witness with pending charges and the disposition of the pending charges will await the testimony in this case, even though there are no agreements and the witness, like as Justice Berger indicated, is probably expecting to score some points, to use your phrase, if they testify truthfully in a manner that's favorable to the state.
Well, I think if that's the situation, that's normally what's asked if somebody has pending charges. Mr. Richmond didn't have pending charges. He had already been convicted.
A pending proceeding.
Yes, he had pending proceeding. What he was trying to do, he had a five-year sentence on one and a three-year sentence on the other. He wanted to combine all those into one five-year sentence because he had just about finished the 5 years. And that's what was ultimately done. I think Mr. Gabay decided to take an alternative route and filed a Rule 35 motion, and that's what he asked for. And ultimately, that was the relief that was granted, that everything was pushed into one. And the theory was that reasonably competent counsel, if they knew that there were two different charges pending, would normally have placed those into a single unified plea, and that it was unfair to Mr. Richmond to have two separate dispositions and two separate sentences because he was a habitual criminal as well. And, you know, he had a good legal argument,
Mr. Gabay testified to that effect, but trying to stay focused here on the legal issue and on Brady, following up on Justice Berger's question, my question is, if there's something pending that involves the state that a witness could benefit from, is that something that should be disclosed as a matter of course? Or if there's no agreement, should it be just left up to the defense attorney to ferret out on cross-examination?
Well, I think if there's something pending, that probably ought to be disclosed. If there's no agreement, then I don't see what the reason for disclosing that is, that we've made no agreement with them. I mean,
it goes back to my distinction highlighted by the cases you discussed between an agreement and an expectation.
Yes.
Because as Justice Berger said in her question, you can legitimately say we have no agreement, but notwithstanding that, there is an expectation on the part of his witness, because we're not going to dispose of the pending proceeding he's involved in until after he testifies in this one.
Well, I think that's true. He does have this expectation, but the problem in the cases, I guess, four goes one way and Davis and the other line go the other way, is that you just have no control over what subjectively is in a witness's mind. The expectations may be entirely unreasonable.
This is objective. This is not subjective. What this would be is to say that the state is obliged to disclose to defense counsel that this witness that they're going to rely on has X, Y, or Z pending or has requested X, Y, or Z in connection with discussing this matter with us. We've made no promises, but that's the objective facts, that this witness has a pending matter, and it's going to be decided after the trial.
Well, I don't see a problem with that, and my advice always to the trial prosecutors is, if there's any conceivable way something could possibly be Brady, you better disclose it right away and get it out there. Then we don't have to argue about these matters. The difficulty becomes when it's not that objective, and it's something purely in someone's mind who's a witness. I mean, they may have unreasonable expectations. Here, Andrus's attorney knew that there was a Rule 61. He specifically asked Mr. Richmond on the witness stand about it. So it wasn't a case where there's a Brady violation. He knew what was going on, and he asked him, and that was fodder for cross-examination of the witness in an attempt to discredit him. So I think here...
So what you're saying in this case is, even if we had this rule about disclosing pending matters and expectations, subjective or objective, in this case, the pendency of the matter was known and the subject of cross-examination.
Yes, yes. I think the record accurately reflects that, both the trial record and the 2009 testimony of Mr. Foley, where I asked him on cross-examination to look at his cross-examination of Mr. Richmond at trial, because at first he thought that he didn't know about it, That was his direct testimony in 2009. I'm looking at the trial record and said, wait a minute, you asked him all these questions. So when I cross-examined Mr. Foley, I said, could you look at this? And he conceded after he read through it that he says, I think I must have known about it. And then I asked him, well, your prior testimony was probably mistaken, and he conceded that it was. So I think even if that's the rule, it was known, it was certainly on the table, and you know, that's where it was. It was laid out for cross-examination. Ultimately, this comes down to a question of credibility. As the finder of fact, the judge sitting at this reconvened Rule 61 had to make credibility determinations.
Well, let me ask you a question about that. Going back to the original abuse of discretion argument, this court has held you can show an abuse of discretion in one of three ways: that the trial judge relied on an irrelevant fact, that the trial judge disregarded a particularly significant fact, or that the trial judge only considered relevant facts, but it's not the product of a logical deductive reasoning process. Here the argument is number two, that these letters were significant and they were not addressed by the trial court, and therefore there was an abuse of discretion by not making a ruling that addressed those particular significant letters.
Well, all those letters, I believe, were introduced at this 2009 reconvened hearing, so they were certainly evidence before the court. I don't recall specifically what was or wasn't said in the written decision, but I think all that was before the judge.
But that's the question. Should the judge's decision have specifically explained why the judge discounted the letters?
Well, I don't know if it has to explicitly say that. I think the judge's finding that Mr. Richmond just wasn't credible, that's enough, and that there wasn't any deal. And the judge also said, and there wasn't any implicit or unstated deal either, that those were the judge's factual and legal findings in the case. And I think that's sufficient, whether it talks about the letters specifically or not. I think they're all kind of part and parcel. That Mr. Letang testified that, oh, yes, he remembered receiving just letter after letter from Mr. Richmond, and Mr. Letang was frustrated about the security issues. And
well, that reminds me, wasn't there some evidence that Mr. Letang had made some note on a yellow pad that supported the idea that there was an understanding? And I say that only because I recall there being some comment, I think, by the court about how Mr. Letang testified that, well, I wouldn't have left it in that condition. If there were an agreement, I would have written something up. It wouldn't just be a note on my yellow pad.
Yes, one of the exhibits was some notes I found in the file. And there was a legal pad, and I think Mr. Letang said that the last five pages were his. He said in there that there was no agreement or promise, and his testimony was that, you know, that was it. If he was actually going to make a deal with somebody, that he wouldn't just have the scrawl, as he calls it, on the legal pad, that he would formalize it and send a letter or something to memorialize it.
So you're saying that there was nothing actually on the legal pad that supported the idea that there was an agreement?
Yes, I think it was the other way that supported it, that there was not an agreement. That's what the legal pad was about. If there's any other questions, I'll certainly try to answer those.
Thanks.
All right. Thank you.
If I can address on the expectation issue, an expectation relates to a witness's motivation to testify, his self-interest, therefore his credibility. Credibility is always an issue, and therefore I suggest an expectation needs to be disclosed. A prosecutor has a high duty. I think and Mr. Letang testified that in 75% of these cases, the inmate who's going to do the testifying always expresses an interest of what it's going to do for me. He testified in this case that he couldn't rule out that Richmond didn't ask for anything. And, in fact, he said, I left the meeting with Richmond with the impression that Richmond was motivated to assist the state, quote, because he thought it would benefit him in some way. That's an express expectation. I understand that there's problems with subjective expectations, because how's a prosecutor to know what's in that person's mind? But when it's expressed, that indicates a motivation to testify, a reason, and the jury should be entitled to hear that.
We may go over your time, and you should go ahead and answer the question as fully as you want to. But let's assume we agree with you. Just make that assumption. What we're hearing from the state is that the pendency of the Rule 61 hearing was known to Mr. Foley, and Richmond was cross-examined about that. So even if you're absolutely right, and expectations should be made known, the state's argument is any expectations he had were made known because the Rule 61 proceeding was even postponed until after Andrus' trial is over.
And in the voir dire, Mr. Gabay misled the defense attorney because he was asked, why is this being delayed? Why is it? And he said in this voir dire that it was being delayed because of my trial schedule and Ms. Purcell's trial schedule. I have that in my brief. And that directly contradicts his real reason for delaying it. He got it delayed. He got Judge Hurley to delay it until after. And then he came here and he told the defense attorney something different. So the defense attorney knew about it, but he was misled on the reason it was delayed. It was never disclosed to the defense attorney that it was delayed because they wanted to wait until after this. And, as a practitioner, I understand what happened. You know, I represent inmates that are trying to parlay information into deals, and I understand that the prosecutor is never going to enter into an express deal. It's a little dance that has to be done. And Mr. Gabay was assisting his client to make sure his credibility was not undermined, because if that comes out, there's no deal. And that's based upon 28 years of practicing. Mr. Gabay, in his motion, stated there's been no discussion about a potential benefit to this. That would be incompetent if any defense attorney didn't try to parlay that help into a deal. And he expressly said, we had no discussions whatsoever. And that's why it just, to me, this whole thing defies common sense about what actually occurred.
We understand your position.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much. The court will take this matter under advisement, and we will adjourn.